You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 14th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and just down the road from the Monocle Cafe. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, seconds out, round umpteen. In Geneva tomorrow, Iran's negotiators meet once more with the representatives of countries unkeen on seeing the Islamic Republic become a nuclear power. We'll be asking our studio guests whether or not Iran are just running out the clock. We'll be bidding farewell to the International Herald Tribune, the last issue of which rolled off the presses today. Does the International New York Times have quite the same ring to it?
So many newspapers are dying because, like all living things, real ones need hearts, souls, and guts. A good newspaper has a personality shaped by and for the people with whom it keeps in close touch. It changes over time, but like ocean quags and olive trees, a healthy one can survive for centuries.
We'll speak to an author who believes that the reputation of America's 28th president is overdue rehabilitation.
I do believe he's the most influential, certainly American figure, maybe world figure of the 20th century.
Later in the show, we'll join architect Peter Murray for coffee and conversation at the Monocle Cafe.
It's this desire to create a balanced environment, balanced social mix, which has great public spaces and buildings that actually last over time, because it's in their interest that they're built well and the place has this sort of long-term feel to it.
And we'll play some music and look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's all coming up on Aperitivo with me, Andrew Muller, right now. So, as always, lots coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Aperitivo, but before of all of that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
As the federal government shutdown in the United States enters a third week now, the head of the International Monetary Fund has warned the budget crisis could tip the world into a global recession. Christine Lagarde said it was vital a deal was agreed before Thursday, when the US Treasury is due to run out of money. In Washington, hundreds of military veterans demanded war memorials be reopened. Republican Senator Ted Cruz told the crowd the president was to blame.
2 weeks ago, the House of Representatives passed legislation to open every memorial in every federal park in this country. 2 weeks ago, the President of the United States signed a written veto threat. He said, if you open the memorial, I will veto it.
Italy is to step up naval and air patrols in the southern Mediterranean to try and prevent repeats of shipwrecks which have drowned hundreds of African migrants in two separate disasters in Sicilian waters in little more than a week, Prime Minister Enrico Letta said on Monday. At least 34 people drowned last Friday when their boat overturned, but with many unaccounted for, the true figure could be as high as 200 or more. And in a separate shipwreck on the 3rd of October, more than 350 people died. Iran has said it will not allow any of its enriched uranium to be shipped abroad. The country's Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi was speaking ahead of talks this week in Geneva on Iran's nuclear program. Representatives from the country will meet international negotiators, the first talks since Iran's new president Hassan Rouhani took office. While Adam Haag from the Foreign Policy Center still thinks the talks could make significant progress.
The Iranians are trying to set their initial red lines, but it's probably not going to be a deal breaker. I think that if there can be sort of solid monitoring procedures on the ground, there may be some wiggle room on that, provided they're able to get progress in other areas.
Meanwhile, in the US, nine Democrat and Republican senators said on Monday they were open to suspending the implementation of new sanctions on Iran, but only if Tehran takes significant steps to slow its nuclear program. A court in Malaysia has said only Muslims can use the word Allah to refer to God. It's banned a Christian newspaper from using the word, saying it could cause confusion. The case comes at a time of heightened ethnic and religious tension in Malaysia after elections early this year. Well, Lawrence Andrew, who's the editor of a Catholic newspaper, The Herald, is worried Malaysia's minority Christian population could be persecuted.
The nation must support and protect the rights of the minorities. So we should not be discouraged, because in this land, we still have the law and we still can hope for our rights to be exercised.
And finally, dozens of people descended on Southwick here in the UK for one of the most British events of the global calendar, as competitors faced each other off in a rainy field to be crowned World Conker Champion. The game involves swinging a conker threaded on the end of a string at the opponent's conker with the aim of smashing it. The loser is the one whose conker shatters first. Britain's Simon Cullum won, according to the competition's organiser, John Burkett.
So we've got the conkers here. These are the conkers you play with, and as you can see, they're on a leather lace. Each player draws them blind. All they can see is the end of the lace in the bag. They then have three strikes each over 5 minutes. And at the end of 5 minutes, if neither conker is broken, then it's a penalty shootout, nine shots each, just like in football, exactly the same.
And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. We didn't really have conkers where I come from. I'm not really sure if eucalyptus trees produce them. Did you ever participate in this pastime?
It seems that, yeah, I did actually as a child. It's great fun. And it's always around this time of year, of course, because conkers fall down on the ground. And it is a kind of schoolboy's prankish game. It's not really, it's for youngsters becoming grown-ups. It obviously sounds like these grown-ups are really children at heart playing this game.
That would be the charitable interpretation. Yes. Were you any good, or is it basically just down to the luck of the draw, as it were?
It's down to aggression, really, and whoever's most aggressive fighting with their conkers wins, I'm afraid. So I wasn't particularly great at it, I have to be honest.
But I think we've learnt something there about how it was that you people conquered an empire on which the sun never set.
Indeed.
You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Aperitivo. The time here in London is 18:07. That's 13:07 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Shashank Joshi, research fellow at London-based defence think tank RUSI, and Baria Alamuddin, foreign editor at Al Hayat News. Welcome both to the programme, both of you. We're starting today with another round of the long-running geostrategic shell game that is Iran's nuclear program. The key point of contention has remained constant, which is that nobody is enthused about the prospect of a cranky theocratic regime with ties to unpleasant non-state militias whose official ideology calls for the destruction of fellow members of the United Nations, acquiring the means to enact its apocalyptic rhetoric. However, neither is anybody much keen on the prospect of having to disarm such an opponent by force. Talks begin again in Geneva tomorrow. Some are minded to be optimistic following the election to Iran's presidency of alleged moderate Hassan Rouhani. But how likely really is any meaningful agreement? Or are we going to be back here again 3, 6, or 12 months from now as Iran run out the clock? I wanted to start first of all by putting to you both a statement from Iran's chief negotiator, also Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. He said he hopes that these talks, and I do occasionally suspect a sort of degree of self-parody among the Iranian diplomats, who I think have more of a sense of humour than they're often given credit for. He says he hopes that these talks can, and I quote, reach agreement on a roadmap to find a path towards resolution. Now, he doesn't sound like a man in a hurry, does he?
Well, actually, the vibes we're hearing is that of people who are really in a hurry. When we saw what Mr. Rouhani did and indeed Mr. Zarifi did in New York, we thought, oh my God, they want a deal yesterday. Nevertheless, with Iran, you never know what they mean. We never know what they're saying, nor you never know who is actually saying what and if what they mean. There is a lot of skepticism in the Arab world. I just came back from a series of Arab countries that I visited, and I tell you, where people are really hopeful that Iran would move around and would come to its senses and make peace with its neighbors and with the world. And of course, everybody is scared about the nuclear
program. I just want to stay with you, Baria, on that point, because this is often framed as a conflict or potential conflict between Iran and Israel. But the truth is it not, that there is not a single Arab country which is terrifically enthused about the idea of a nuclear Iran either, is there?
Absolutely. I mean, if you take a country like Qatar or Kuwait or Bahrain, they're so close to Iran. Any nuclear destruction or any nuclear problem or any nuclear accident would spill all over that place. And people are really worried about that. Nevertheless, not only that, but also they are all worried about what Iran is doing in the area, what they are doing in Lebanon, my country, where they support somebody like Hezbollah, and you know, we all know what Hezbollah is doing now in Syria. Also, the Yemen, they support the Houthis in Yemen, and we know what's happening in Yemen. We all know what they do in Bahrain and other places. So the Iranians are not this lovey-dovey, you know, that they are trying to show us in this. The UN. Nevertheless, this is an important country. It's an Islamic country. And people really wish that Iran would change its image, but not only its image, its deed.
Shashank Joshi, I'll bring you in at this point. Is there a possibility, and again, I'm attempting to summon up some optimism here, is it possible that Iran is aware that they've possibly pushed their luck about as far as they can, and they're looking for a dignified way to climb down, as it were?
Yeah, first of all, I don't know what would give anyone scepticism about the concept of a roadmap in the Middle East, given that the last one we tried worked so terrifically well that we're obviously seeing peace in the Holy Land as we speak.
Like I said, I think elements in the Iranian regime funnier than we often give them credit for.
But, you know, I think actually the term roadmap actually is a good thing, because what it means is, I think John Kerry said this in New York, they're talking about the end game. And that's a euphemism. It's sort of an allusion to the idea that they might be saying behind the scenes, look, Iran, we know you want the right to enrich uranium, and we know we want you to stop doing that, but we're willing to talk about a situation where you can do that. So the term roadmap is actually a good thing in this context. I think my own view of this is that there are very, very sound reasons to be optimistic. And it's not just because Iran, as you say, is desperate, although I think they are. Rouhani was elected on a mandate to reduce Iran's economic suffering, and he knew perfectly well that could only be done with painful nuclear concessions. I think there's also a little bit of desperation or concern on the other side. There's concern if this drags on into the middle of next year, Iran's capacity to enrich uranium, its number of centrifuges, is piling up. And at some point, it becomes very, very cagey indeed as to whether it can break out to a sufficient fissile material for one bomb without being detected. So I think both sides have a bit of urgency here. No one wants to see negotiations collapse. And I'm very optimistic about this round.
I think we only can be optimistic when tomorrow comes and we see what they are going to offer. If they're going to start this round like they started all the other rounds, we want our role in the Middle East. We can give you Syria, we can give you Lebanon, we can give you that, and there's not going to be a deal. I just spoke to somebody who's very close to the talks, and they're very keen on going the diplomatic road. Everybody's sick of wars in that part of the world. Nevertheless, I have not spoken to one person who really believes that Iran is 100%. Everybody is still skeptical deep down, but they want to go the road.
There's a reciprocal skepticism here, of course. From Iran's part, I feel
it's... Again, not unreasonably, when you look at the world from where they're standing.
Iran, of course, needs to understand that if it wants sanctions relief, it has to give up a lot that it's so far been unwilling to do. But from Iran's point of view, they're worried, I think, that if they give up even a lot, they look at people in the US Congress who are saying, we won't lift an ounce of sanctions. And of course, there are 9 rounds of sanctions, many of which can be lifted by the president himself, but others which will require new bills. And look at the state of Congress today. Look at the rhetoric, not just towards each other, and of course we have the government shutdown, but towards Iran. Iran is legitimately worried, if we give something up, will we actually see the fruits of this?
But can I say something also? What's very important is to watch what Iran is doing right now. Just 2 days ago, there was a massacre near Syria, which took place under Iranian instructions almost, and with Hezbollah and the Syrian army. 130 people were massacred. literally their throats slashed. This is not a good omen, because Iranians promised that they are going to play a positive role in Syria.
Well, there are multiple Irans who we're talking about here. I mean, I don't think anyone thinks Rouhani
the problem.
Has it within his power. I think the important thing to understand is, although, yes, Khamenei calls all the shots, Rouhani has been given some authority on this issue. We've already seen, for example, the nuclear file in Iran has been transferred out of the Supreme National Security Council to the foreign ministry, run by Javad Zarif. Now, nobody thinks a Syria file has been transferred away from the IRGC. So actually, I don't think it's a bad omen. Of course, it's an awful, awful act, and Iran has blood on its hands in Syria. But don't read too much into that and extrapolate it into the nuclear negotiations, would be my view.
But this is the problem, isn't it? That we know that it's not Rouhani or his foreign minister that are really in charge. We don't know when Mr. Khamenei will change his mind. Indeed, we saw Mr. Rouhani being thrown with shoes when he arrived in
by a minority of people and rabble-rousers who, be expected. It doesn't mean he can't strike a deal.
No, I'm not saying this. If Khamenei wants to strike a deal, then the deal will be struck. If Khamenei doesn't want, so it's Mr. Rouhani is just the face, is just the smiley face. He's not the one who decides.
Been given latitude within certain boundaries, which is different from being a pure figurehead. But I do, of course, agree Khamenei does exercise the ultimate veto.
I did want to ask as well, it's Iran and the P5 plus one who are meeting. And while returning to Baria's point that everyone in the Middle East is absolutely and entirely sick of war, and quite understandably, a obvious key player in this drama is not going to be in the room in Geneva. And how much of a focusing factor, both on Iran and on the other parties to these talks, is the fact that ultimately, when it comes down to it, as they have demonstrated many times in their history, Israel will do what it thinks it has to do when it thinks it has to do it?
I tell you, I actually had a briefing with somebody quite senior in a Western, from a Western country. Unfortunately, these are off-the-record briefings. And to be honest with you, they're very, very worried that the Israelis are not going to listen. The Israelis just had exercises near with their planes near Athens near Greece. Not exactly on the territory of Greece, but near there. We have been hearing voices from Netanyahu claiming that he doesn't believe now. But I do not necessarily agree with Mr. Netanyahu on anything. But in this instance, I must say that the Israelis should be worried, because the rhetoric coming from Iran, especially with Mr. Khatami, Khamenei, are not really good ones. What everybody wants to hear from Iran is deeds. People don't want tweets and Facebook messages.
How about the release of 80 political prisoners? How's that for a deed?
Oh, I'm happy, but how many are still there?
Many, but of course you start somewhere.
You know what? Iran cannot live alone in that area. And if they do not stop causing problems in Iraq, in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Bahrain, and other places, then nobody's going to believe it. I'm sorry.
I think you're right insofar as the nuclear dispute is only one dispute amongst many. And we're kidding ourselves if we think when this is fixed, it's all solved. But I also think that we shouldn't make the perfect the enemy of the good. And if we can strike a nuclear deal, I'm afraid I see Saudi Arabian policy, Israeli policy as being deeply, horrendously obstructionist on this issue, and that actually they have their legitimate concerns. Of course, it's legitimate for Israel to be concerned about Iranian support to Hezbollah and the grotesque statements coming out of the leadership. But it's a fantastic thing if political prisoners are being released, if cultural restrictions are being lifted, and if we can strike a nuclear deal to end a dispute that has hung over our heads for 10 years now. And I'm afraid I have to also say, the Saudis have been extremely activist in the region over the past several years, to the point where I'm afraid I don't think their role in the region has been constructive at all recently.
Okay, can I just say something? I totally see your point when you're coming that this is many questions that concern Iran. Nevertheless, I think you agree with me that people in the area are not the ones who started really attacking Iran and meddling with the internal situation in Iran. It's actually the opposite. It's Iran who came and made something called Hezbollah and paid a lot of money. It's Iran who's actually running the war in Syria. Syria is an Arab country. It's not a Persian country. True, it's an Islamic country, but it's an Arab country. Iraq is an Arab country.
But that's a very ethnic way of looking at it. Can only Arabs intervene in Arab countries?
Yes, I hope so.
What,
yes, of course.
Are Europeans can interfere in other European countries? We can interfere in France or Germany?
No, I don't want anybody to interfere in anybody's situation. I want everybody to be an independent country.
So Saudi Arabia should cut its support for rebels then?
Well, this is, I tell you, Syria is different.
I think, yes, of course,
I think Saudi Arabia should stop, but let the Iranians stop, let the Iraqis stop, and let all the others stop.
Sure.
Saudi Arabia does not have troops in Syria. Does it?
Well, it doesn't need to, but no, Iran doesn't have troops in Lebanon, does it?
Of course it does, when you have thousands of troops from Iraq and from Hezbollah and Iran running the war. Of course they do, but they don't. I'm not defending this policy. I am just stating that actually Iran is the one who's been playing the baddie, not the others.
Baria and Shashank, I suspect we may get, given the history of the region, future opportunities to discuss various crises in the Middle East. For the moment, thank you very much. We'll be taking a short break and we'll be right back.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whiskey, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me is Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute and Baria Alamuddin, foreign editor at Al Hayat News. A venerable masthead disappears from the world's newsstands tomorrow as the International Herald Tribune is rechristened the International New York Times. It is, in truth, a formal acknowledgement of a relationship that goes back more than 20 years when the Times bought half of the Tribune, purchasing the other half in 2002. The IHT's former editor, Mort Rosenblum, spoke to Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield earlier today.
I'd come to Paris in 1977 to run the Associated Press, and back then the paper was in this funny little place on the Rue de Berry in the middle of downtown Paris, and we were all buddies, and we drank together and stuff, and there was a new publisher had come in, there's been an ownership change, and he asked me to run the paper. The old editor was leaving, and so I leapt at it because I've been a reporter all my life. I'm a reporter again, but I thought, why not see if I can't join the bosses and see what it's like? And we had a hell of a time for a couple of years. But it was during those two years that we took the paper around the world. We began printing not only in Paris but also in Asia and elsewhere in Europe, and by the time I left, it obviously wasn't just my thing, but we built up quickly. But by the time I left, we were circulating in 180-something countries around the world.
And why was it that the IHT was able to do it in a way that... I mean, because at the time, now, obviously, all the big newspapers have a huge online presence. They like to see themselves as global newspapers. Why was it that the IHT at the time was the only one to really seriously do that?
Well, it really typified and exemplified, I have to say, quite well. I mean, whoever ran the paper during all those periods, the best of what has been then and still slightly is this American form of journalism, whereby you know, we know objective is a moving target, but try very much to be what fair and balanced is supposed to be. You know, you tell the news in the best way, you interpret it as possible, but in a way, and you separate the news columns from the thought and the editorial. And there are enough people in the world, there were then and there certainly are now, that understand the difference, that to understand and cover a story, you have to actually be there, and the Trib did that.
Yeah, as you say, it's a newspaper that understood that you needed to report things and get out there. I mean, do you think that its passing, you know, also sort of symbolises the passing of that type of journalism? You know, when you the New York Times has a lovely little thing online today of you know, how great the IHT was, but it's got shots of troops in Romania reading about the fall of Ceausescu. You know, that has just happened, that they were part of. It's got Martin Luther King reading about a speech that he'd given. That sort of reporting, particularly the Romanian reporting, that would perhaps happen less on papers these days.
You know, I think so. I mean, you know, just a few minutes ago when you know, you guys were that told me you were going to give a call, I pulled up this little piece I wrote when the Trib went, and I mean, when they announced it, and I mean, just one little graph I wrote. So many newspapers are dying because, like all living things, real ones need heart, souls, and guts. A good newspaper has a personality shaped by and for the people with whom it keeps in close touch. It changes over time, but like ocean quags and olive trees, a healthy one can survive for centuries.
It was Mort Rosenblum, the former editor of the International Herald Tribune, reflecting on its glory days with Steve Bloomfield earlier. I still have Shashank Joshi and Baria Alamuddin with me. Will you miss the IHT's masthead, Shashank? I'll come to you first.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time in airports. That's one of those papers I instinctively pick up when I can't get my favourite British papers. And I think I will miss the masthead. You know, synonymous with really fantastic... I mean, as an editor, I'm sure, Barry, you'll acknowledge the sheer quality of their coverage. I have so much respect for foreign correspondents associated with both the IHT and the New York Times, people who've done great work right now, including in Syria. So I will miss that. But I think, you know, it's a content that matters, and that's what I'll keep getting.
Baru? Well,
guess what? We agree.
It was bound to happen sooner or later.
Yes. I actually lived in Paris for 3-4 years during the Lebanese Civil War. And one of the things that really helped me pass and read the news was the Herald Tribune. And you know what I like about it? I like that it's not one of those very thick newspapers that you have to flick and flick. And then finally you get to the world news. So I like it and I respect it. And there are many writers there that I read. And I'm glad it's not disappearing. But you know what? Most of the papers now we read online, it's silly, it's sad, but it's so much available now. But I still like the touch of the paper.
You wake up in the morning, I mean, at this point, given how much I rely on Twitter, and I'm sure many listeners do, and on internet stories, it feels like it's just you're reading this sort of gazette from 10 years ago when you open a paper, physical paper in the morning sometimes, because you've gutted all the stories when they initially came out on the web at 7 p.m. the night before.
That is unfortunately the trouble with modern physical newspapers. It is, they are reporting, well, I mean, I suppose newspapers have always reported by definition yesterday's news, but the trouble is now we all know that. Do you think the new master, do you think it has the same ring to it, the International New York Times? It's clearly an attempt to extend the New York Times brand overseas.
I mean, the New York Times is a very well-respected newspaper, and I'm thinking its name being there is a plus, not a minus. This is a very old newspaper, I mean, and it also has really, through the years, have kept its prestigious write-ups, the column that are there, and also it's a quality newspaper. So I'm sure the name being there is for me. It's not going to change anything. I'm going to still look at the same things and read the same columnists. Nevertheless, I think I have a feeling that most newspapers these days are suffering with their paper editions. We have much more readers now online than we have people reading the actual newspaper. Although that's not in the Arab world. Most of the readers in Australia and the States and Japan and all the Arabs, they actually read it mostly online.
You know, there are very few papers who have an international brand. FT, The Economist, and The Tribune's one of them. And so I think people who read it will know that ultimately the content is all still there.
And we will have to leave it there. Shashank Joshi and Baria Alamuddin, thank you very much for joining us here on Aperitivo at Midori House.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres,
Toronto,
Tóquio.
Essa é a Mônaco 24.
Hongkong, Zürich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hongkong,
Hongkong,
Zürich,
London,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hongkong, Zürich, London. To buy Monocle, 26 Che Che Che.
From London,
London, London,
Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's aperitivo. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe to talk architectural development in London, and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily. But ahead of all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Andrew, thanks very much. As the federal government shutdown in the United States enters a third week now, the head of the International Monetary Fund has warned the budget crisis could tip the world into a global recession. Christine Lagarde said it was vital a deal was agreed before Thursday, when the US Treasury is due to run out of money. Italy's to step up naval and air patrols in the southern Mediterranean to try and prevent repeats of shipwreck wrecks, which have drowned hundreds of African migrants in two separate disasters in Sicilian waters in little more than a week, Prime Minister Enrico Letta said on Monday. Iran has said it will not allow any of its enrichment uranium to be shipped abroad. The country's deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, was speaking ahead of talks this week in Geneva on Iran's nuclear program. And a court in Malaysia has said only Muslims can use the word Allah to refer to God. It's banned a Christian newspaper from using the word, saying it could cause confusion. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. It's 21:31 in Moscow. That's 18:31 here in London, 14:31 in Rio. It's time now to head to the Monocle Cafe on Chilton Street for a flat white and a chat. Today we meet Peter Murray, chairman of New London Architecture, an independent forum on the built environment. On October 17th, the NLA will open an exhibition on the great estates of this city, those historic landowners who developed and in some cases still own vast patches of London. Peter met up with Monocle's David Michon at our cafe to discuss how this model has inspired new development here, such as King's Cross and the Olympic Park, as well as London's other urban future, the tall building.
Here we are in Marylebone, the centre of London. This is a part of the Howard de Walden estate, which was redeveloped in the early 18th century. Marylebone High Street, that was regenerated only in the last decade through very careful planning by the Howard de Walden estate, which then had a very, might say, holistic impact on the area, in that not only did they get better shops, it became a destination, but also that impacted on the demand for the residential around it. It was good for the values for the Howard de Walden estate, and it created a really nice sort of area, just the sort of area that Monocle would like to be in, really.
And I'm wondering if this has application, or you're seeing other cities around the world kind of look at this as a model, you know, particularly in an era where a lot of countries are building cities from scratch. You know, are they looking at kind of divvying up cities into these management areas, you know, so that they have a unique character, or a single vision, and that drives urban development?
Well, I think obviously where you have newer cities that are expanding very fast, you are creating these large areas. I don't actually think the message has quite got out yet that you need to look at it in the holistic way that a lot of the estates are at the moment. So that's to a certain extent what we're promoting through this exhibition, is to try and get people to understand that although some people looking back, you might say this is rather feudal, you know, the aristocrats in London still running the place. But actually what these estates have done is they've transformed themselves really into property corporations, and they operate in a very different, might say, more democratic way than maybe they did in the past. And I do think they have lessons for cities all around the world, because as you say, you know, they are developing large areas of land which can benefit from this sort of approach.
You know, I'm wondering, there seems to be this serious fear by city dwellers of the property developer. You know, they're often kind of pitted against City Hall and against kind of the best interests of, you know, people living in a city. But in fact, you know, with these developers who kind of own huge tracts of the city, you know, the De Waldens or Capco, for instance, who have Covent Garden as well as Earl's Court in London, in a sense, those property developers who own more of a kind of collected, you know, patch of the city, are kind of allies of the city. You know, they're interested more in urban development as opposed to building a single tower that might yield them the most profit.
Yes, I think people are afraid not so much of developers, but more of speculators, I think, because, you know, so much development has been short-term, people wanting to take the money and running, basically. And what we're looking at here is a long-term view of the city. And so it is in the estate's interest to have this broad mix of both people there, but of uses, so that it's a really active, vibrant part of the city, which maintains its value over literally hundreds of years. And it's interesting you should mention Capco, who are looking at Covent Garden, and they've bought the sort of central area of Covent Garden, but are now buying up other pieces of property around it to create a larger estate. And Ian Hawksworth, actually, who is the chief executive of Capco, used to be in Hong Kong and was chief executive of Hong Kong Land, where they also have this view of, in central in Hong Kong, of bringing together a whole series of properties which provide this broad mixed use to the city in a way that is properly managed and is looked at over the long term. So I think it's this desire to create a balanced environment, balanced social mix, which has great public spaces and buildings that actually last over time, because it's in their interest that they're built well and the place has this sort of long-term feel to it.
Now let's kind of fast forward to some of London's newer developments, or its new image, which is of one that is increasingly tall. You know, London is, or the city of London is becoming home to a collection of tall buildings where once, you know, it was not. I'm just wondering kind of what is your initial reaction to that?
You could say that towers are a part of London's DNA, really, because if you look at the Canaletto view of the City of London in the 18th century, you had St. Paul's totally out of scale with all the rest of the buildings around it, and scattered in amongst the spires of the Wren churches that then you know, poked up above the city in the way that contemporary towers do amongst a city which is now much higher than it was, of course, in the 17th century. Houses were probably 3-4 stories high. Now in the city you're looking at 6 or 7 stories, and then taller buildings up to 20 stories probably have a similar sort of scale. So I don't think it's totally out of context with London's DNA. I think, you know, the key thing is to make sure that what towers we build are the sort of quality that of some of Wren's buildings. And for instance, you know, I love the Shard, I love the St. Mary Axe, the Gherkin. These are real contributions to the skyline. So I think where we build good buildings, we don't want the nasty concrete slabs of the 1960s. We want really good buildings which will enhance the skyline. Now, of course, you've got to look at why this is happening. One of the key reasons is that London is becoming more dense, because we don't want to have the sort of sprawl where London just spreads all over the southeast as we did in the 1930s. And London is also increasing its population. You know, an extra 100,000 people per year are being added on. That means that we have to provide new housing, new shops, new places to work for all these people. It's, you know, it's a new town every few years. So in order to do that, we have to become more dense. And so buildings will inevitably get higher. The average will be higher, but every now and then you will have taller buildings. And we're organising an exhibition next year which will look at this, and we've already identified something like 200 towers above 20 floors high which are, you know, in the pipeline to happen over the next few years. And this is also being driven by the fact that London is a key part of the global economy now, and we're seeing huge amounts of investment in property from Singapore, China, the Far East generally, who are keen to invest in taller buildings, in towers. And for instance, there's a tower now being designed on the Nine Elms on the south bank of the Thames, not far from the Houses of Parliament, which will be 54 floors high, very high for London. And that is by a Chinese developer, who I think is probably hoping that the Chinese embassy is going to move to that area, and that will provide the sort of accommodation that Chinese occupiers actually want. So we're a global city, and we are actually responding to global investment and global demand. And if you look at somewhere like Toronto, this has happened. You know, if you look at Vancouver, this has happened there under the sort of whole Vancouverism idea of a dense urban centre with towers. A lot of those towers are driven by demand from the Chinese mainland.
That was the architect Peter Murray speaking with Monocle's David Michon at the Monocle Cafe. Up next, we discuss America's 28th president, a sixpence prize if you don't need to look that up. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians of the Glenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
As our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living begins hitting shelves around the world, our editors take to the road to celebrate the launch of this 408-page survey on how to live well. We're visiting our favourite bookstores and retailers in 15 cities across the globe to meet subscribers, contributors, and fans. Join us for a glass of wine, a spot of shopping, and a chance to meet the team. To find out where we're heading in September and October, keep an eye on book.monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Woodrow Wilson, the 28th President of the United States, was one of the most influential, yet least understood, occupants of the White House. He is remembered principally as a somewhat naive idealist who, having led his country into World War I, subsequently attempted to build a world safe for democracy and almost worked himself to death in the process. His grandest design, the proto-UN, called the League of Nations, was a failure, but does that mean Wilson was? Pulitzer Prize-winning author A. Scott Berg believes not. His new biography of Wilson, audaciously titled Wilson, makes the case for an unusual man and a remarkable president. Scott spoke earlier to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Steve wanted to know if Wilson was really overdue a reassessment.
Oh yes, by all means we should. If for no other reason, I do believe he's the most influential, certainly American figure, maybe world figure, of the 20th century. His influence is felt to this day, certainly in American foreign policy. And domestically, our whole economy is really built on the Federal Reserve System, which Woodrow Wilson established 100 years ago. So he's with us. So you can love him or you can hate him, but you should know him.
Let's look at the good stuff, first of all. I mean, if you were to summarize that the main achievements which you feel that have that 100 years on are still worth talking about, what is it that you feel Wilson really did for America?
Well, he really became the first modern president. He redefined what the job was, and he also came in with an agenda of great progressivism. He ran on a program called the New Freedom, which was largely an economic freedom. And with that came a kind of leveling of the playing field in America. And that is why he brought in the Federal Reserve System, why he introduced the modern income tax, which was a redistribution of wealth, again, leveling the playing field. He put the first Jew in America on the Supreme Court, the eight-hour workday, workmen's compensation. All these things were Wilsonian ideas. That's just domestically. Then internationally, Woodrow Wilson gave a speech in April of 1917, when he led America into the First World War. And that one speech, in fact, one sentence within that speech, has become the nucleus of American foreign policy to this day. And that one sentence was, "The world must be made safe for democracy." And as recently as a few weeks ago, President Obama was talking about what America's role should be in Syria. And he was talking about the question, should America become the policeman of the world? Or on the other hand, can we look the other way when a dictator is massacring 1,000 of his own people? Does America not have a certain responsibility? Well, those questions go directly back to Woodrow Wilson. That is Wilsonian theory.
And yet, you know, Obama also has the same problems that Wilson has in that, you know, it's all very well saying, you know, yes, he was an international president who thought that America had a role to play in the world, but he struggled to convince enough people back home that that should be the case.
Yes, that's exactly right. And in fact, when Wilson returned from Europe, holding the Treaty of Paris with the League of Nations part of that treaty, he encountered a very hostile Republican Senate who had to ratify that treaty, rather the way President Obama is finding a very hostile Congress himself on passing anything. I often think President Obama should be ripping a few pages out of the Wilson rulebook, though. There are a lot of lessons he could learn from President Wilson, who, like Obama, was extremely eloquent. Wilson, however, used his eloquence to keep a sustained dialogue. There was always a conversation going on between Wilson and his Congress, between Wilson and his countrymen, which sometimes President Obama does not do.
You say that, but despite that, he couldn't get the League of Nations to be ratified by the Senate. He may well have been talking to Congress, but they didn't necessarily like him, did they?
No, that's exactly right. They did not always like him, and especially toward the end, they didn't. And in fact, when President Wilson could not get the Senate to pay attention to his League of Nations, Wilson tried to circumvent them by taking his case directly to the people. And in fact, he embarked in 1919 on a 29-city tour around the country in which he was starting to change hearts and minds in America, when suddenly he collapsed, in fact, and returned to Washington, where he suffered a stroke, which led to actually one of the great conspiracies still little known in America, in which Mrs. Wilson and a handful of doctors kept from the world the fact that the President of the United States had suffered a stroke.
Well, exactly. And this is where some of the slight contradictions come in, because you know, you say he's a Democrat and that he was a big believer in democracy around the world, but no one elected Mrs. Wilson. And you know, how can you square that idea of, you know, his belief in democracy with, you know, not respecting the Constitution when he was ill?
Well, he respected the Constitution as far as it went in those days. And the truth of the matter is he was too ill to have made that decision. The decision was made strictly by Mrs. Wilson and this handful of doctors. Wilson was, in fact, in bed, paralyzed, very, very weak. Couldn't have made that decision if he wanted. And I would say also, since that time, there is an amendment in the U.S. Constitution that came in directly as a result of the Wilson case, which really defines what presidential disability is, what that incapacity is. And Wilson was certainly suffering from it. But again, they obeyed the Constitution as far as it went. They just realized it didn't go far enough.
I want to look at another contradiction as well. You say he was a progressive. You mentioned that there was the first Jewish Supreme Court judge. And yet, this was a man who appointed segregationists, who was, you know, many people would look at now and consider a racist, in some ways a supremacist.
You're exactly right. I hesitate to call him a supremacist, but he certainly was racist to a degree. I call him a genteel racist in the book. And it's something I'm trying to explain, not to excuse him in any way, because it's rather inexcusable, especially 100 years later. But we can't suffer from presentism either. We have to look at the world in which he lived. Woodrow Wilson was a Southerner. He was born before the Civil War. He was born and raised in a racially segregated society. When he came to Washington, which was, after all, a very small Southern town at that point, there was talk of integration, and Wilson just realized the city and the country was not ready for it, or at least that's what he believed. And he believed that because he knew enough virulent segregationists, enough racists, whom indeed, as you suggest, he did put in his cabinet, all of which tells you something larger, which is, Wilson was genuinely a centrist in his day.
Well, yeah, but here's the thing that I was confused about, was because it's one thing to say he's a product of his time and he felt that they weren't, you know, America wasn't ready for these changes. But actually, in some cases, his people were making things worse. They were introducing new segregation.
Yes, there had been some inroads made in integration, and indeed Wilson did set that cause back, and I think it's something. I think the main reason his reputation has now suffered, now that America has integrated, or at least to a great extent, certainly a much greater extent than it was 100 years ago. But this is a large part of the reason for Wilson being in some disfavor right now. And it's especially difficult to explain to a younger generation who grew up in America in the mid-century, and I remember segregation. I mean, I remember different drinking fountains and different lunchrooms and so forth in the United States. So it wasn't all that long ago. It's hard to get our hands around it now. But make no mistake about it, you are right. He made statements that were definitely racist, and he did, I think, set back the cause. He felt he was putting off a revolution that the country wasn't ready for.
And that was A. Scott Berg, author of a new biography of Woodrow Wilson, speaking with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, and moving seamlessly along to this evening's musical interlude. This, and this is Liquid programming this, Vic Chestnut with Woodrow Wilson. That was Vic Chestnut with Woodrow Wilson, although I, for one, would have been interested to hear a song called Vic Chestnut by Woodrow Wilson. But never mind. He died far, far too soon to even contemplate such a thing. You are listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We are approaching the end of the programme, but before we get there, we will look at what's coming up on tonight's shows and also on tomorrow and Wednesday's editions of Aperitivo, which will be coming live from Frieze here in London. And I, for one, actually, I don't really care whether the weather improves or not, because I'm not going to be presenting it. Anyway, but we know a man who is. I'm joined by producers Barbara Feeney and Thomas Lewis, and also our culture editor, Rob Bound. Rob, we should start with the Frieze programmes tomorrow and Wednesday. For some reason, I just have this image in my head of you actually broadcasting from the windswept expanses of Hyde Park.
Luckily, there's a tent. Is that mad jiving you're doing? Is that a rain dance?
You're trying to sabotage
my show.
Exactly what I'm doing. I'm imagining it's going to be like, you know, those stupid things that television news always does when there's a storm brewing and they send someone out. Some poor sat down to the shoreline to get his umbrella blown inside out to demonstrate that wind is windy and rain is wet. I'm imagining you in that role.
That is exactly going to be me. I'm going to be stylishly accoutred in Frieze and Frieze Masters, Andrew. That's what I'm going to be. I'm going to be under this sort of subtle. It's 50 Shades of Grey, as we know. The Frieze guys are very particular about the colour schemes inside the tent. I think you're allowed three types of the 50 Shades of Grey. I don't know what they would be. Should we surmise what they might be? Let's not. It's a family show, isn't it?
Yeah. Let's really not.
But anyway, I should sell my show, shouldn't I?
You should. Aperitivo at 1800 hours tomorrow and Wednesday. What's going to be on them?
So tomorrow we're at Frieze Masters, which premiered last year, new art fair for old art. So that's everything from antiquities to modern. So it was wonderful. You've got sort of like church friezes from sort of 14th century Spain, nicked. next to Matisse's and Gerhard Richter's and things like that. So it's a pretty amazing thing. And that's a very kind of cool, calm, collected fair, sort of all very carpeted and lush. And then Frieze London, Frieze Contemporary, as it's kind of being slangly known now, is on Wednesday. And that seems really kind of riotous and contemporary compared to all the old gear that's on at Frieze Master. So, yeah, we're at 6 o'clock tomorrow and 6 o'clock on Wednesday. So it should be good. We've got some good guests lined up, some amusing characters who will probably sort of lead us down the garden path that involves bad language and but lots of sort of high dudgeon.
A garden path that may not be negotiable without Wellington boots and sou'westers. But yes, we do look forward to
it. It does have
that.
A roof on it.
ahead of that, of course, we have tonight's programmes here on Monocle 24, The Globalist Asia and The Monocle Daily. And I have the producers of those, Barbara Feeney and Thomas Lewis, with me as well. Which one? Who's going first? Who's doing Globalist Asia?
I'm going first.
What's on Globalist Asia tonight?
So Globalist Asia, Emma Nelson will be bringing us Globalist Asia tonight. We are in Syria because the OPCW have pleaded for a short ceasefire so they can actually get on with their work.
This is the Nobel Prize winning.
Yes, forgive me. Forgive me for not saying
that.
Well,
no, I'm just wondering if their life is now easier. They can now ring people and go, yeah, we've been in all the papers. You've heard of us. Oh, you're those guys.
So they're finding it rather tricky to actually carry out their work because of, you know, fighting going on, especially in kind of rebel-held areas. So we're going to be talking to Fawaz Jirjes from LSE. And then we are going to Pakistan to talk about Malala Yousafzai's book. And we were getting the feeling on the ground, you know, how well it was received. We spoke earlier to a bookseller in Karachi. And we also heard from our man in Islamabad, Imtiaz Tayyab.
So okay.
Quite interesting to hear how, you know, in different parts of Pakistan, obviously there's different receptions. But the man I spoke to in Karachi said it was very popular. They were sold out of the book.
Good. Unequivocally good. Thomas Lewis, tonight's Daily.
Yes, indeed. So in about an hour's time, Andrew, President Obama is holding a meeting at the White House of congressional leaders. Obviously, the deadline of a possible default on the US national debt is fast approaching on Thursday the 17th. Tension is rising. Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, did a big round of interviews on Sunday. The chief of the World Bank, Jim Yong Kim, he's also come out and said that these are dangerous times. So we'll be bringing you the latest on that. Then from one tale of intrigue to the next, we go inside the Food Network to see how it became, this TV channel became the kingmaker of the culinary wannabes in the United States of America.
There used to be a channel in the UK called the Carlton Food Network, and I wrote a show for them once, which we thought about. We thought up in the back of a taxi on the way to the commissioning editor of ITV, and it was Roland Riveron driving around on a scooter drunk, and we called it Cheesy Rider. 12 episodes. Just saying.
Honestly, more of that on tomorrow, Wednesday's Aperitivo at 1800. Globalist Asia coming up at 2000, the Daily at 22. And that's all for today's Aperitivo. My thanks to our studio guests, Sashank Joshi and Barya Alamuddin, and our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, the researchers, Alexa Firminich and Andrea Alacon, and our studio manager, Chris Chilvers. Next up is Culture with Rob Bound, who meets one of the biggest names in British art, Damien Hirst. I've been Andrew Muller for this edition of Aperitivo. It's goodbye and thanks for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.